So a Grand Prix driver over the course of the weekend, when they're not driving or with sponsor commitments, they're in debriefs, they're looking at data. And again, that's where, you know, AI helps. We got so much data, 1.5 terabytes. What we need is the good data. So that's what modern day technology is helping, us cipher through what is the good data, what is the data that we really need.
Welcome to Ask More of AI, the podcast looking at the intersection of AI and business. I'm Clara Shai, CEO of Salesforce AI, and I'm sitting down today with Zach Brown, the CEO of McLaren Racing. Zach, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Where are you located today?
Today I'm in Surrey, not far from our factory. Just got back from our two-week shutdown and headed to the Dutch Grand Prix this weekend.
Wow, what a fabulous life you must lead.
It's a lot of travel. It's a lot of travel. It's fun most of the time.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. And it's just a fascinating personal story of yours and also a fascinating story behind McLaren as an organization. So very excited to sit down with you today.
Thank you.
So maybe we start with McLaren. I know so many racing teams, they start out as car companies that then get into racing as a means of marketing and promotion. I was reading about McLaren. It seems like it was the reverse. So can you take us back to 1962 and just the early days of McLaren and how that started, and then how and why then in the 90s you all started producing cars?
Yeah, so Bruce McLaren, our founder, was a racer, a great one, a car designer. Actually did his first road car in the middle of the 60s, which not many people know. I think they just produced literally a handful, and he was quite a pioneer and an innovator, kind of raced everything. He won Le Mans, won Formula One races, won the Can-Am Championship, and was kind of, as racing was back in the 60s, a small entrepreneur. He was unfortunately killed in a racing accident in 1970 after having started the racing team and been successful. It then went into the hands of Teddy Mayer in the early 70s, who had worked on the team. They went on to win their first world championship in 1974, and the same year won the Indy 500. We have since won Le Mans, so we're the only team to have won what's called the Triple Crown, which are the three biggest races in motor racing, the Indy 500, the Monaco Grand Prix, and the Indy 500. And then the team started to struggle at the end of that decade, the late 70s, early 80s, and was then acquired by Ron Dennis and Mansur Auger, who had a tremendous amount of success, 20 world championships. Kind of the most dominant team in the 80s and 90s, with some of the most legendary racing drivers, Niki Lauda, Ayrton Senna, James Hunt, Alain Prost, etc. And then we did a supercar, 106, called the McLaren F1 in the mid to late 90s, which was a kind of a spinoff of the racing team. And then we got really into the road car business when Mercedes acquired a majority stake in our racing team. And we did what were called the McLaren SLRs through the 2000s. And then we wanted to get really into the road car business under our own brand. And then that's when we bought out Mercedes and we started the road car business now just a little over a decade ago. And so now we've got this great Formula One, IndyCar, Formula E team, you know, all under the McLaren Racing umbrella. And then we've got a great automotive business run by a gentleman named Michael Leiters. So we have two CEOs within McLaren Group, Michael Leiters, who runs our automotive business, and myself, who runs all things motor racing.
It's just fascinating to go from this highly experiential entertainment company to now also offering these iconic cars. And of course, those two sides of the business, you know, feed off of each other and go together so well. And then in the process, you know, the world, you know, the audience for who is coming to these events, it's also broadened. Can you talk about how the evolution of who the fans are and how that's changed over the last decades?
Yeah, it's been a phenomenal growth. We were already the world's largest annual sporting event. Only the Olympics and the World Cup are bigger. And of course, those aren't annual.
Amazing.
As a single entity, right? Football's huge, yeah, but it's multiple different leagues. When Liberty acquired the sport in late 2016, I think they saw that we weren't very good. We had this huge fan base and massive popularity, but we weren't where we needed to be in North America. We weren't where we needed to be around inclusivity. We needed a younger and more diverse audience. And once Liberty acquired the sport, I think they saw a diamond that just needed some polishing. Netflix has obviously been a huge contributor. And fast forward, 75% of our new fans are women and youth. We're massive in North America. We have three races, a new television contract, a new movie coming out next year that Brad Pitt's doing, which will be sensational.
Incredible.
It's a very high production. So the sport has never been healthier. 24 Grand Prix, our calendar's maxed out. We have countries lining up to want to host more Grand Prix. And then, of course, with the success has come a tremendous amount of corporate partners that hadn't previously been in the sport, that are your, you know, who's who of the Fortune 500 companies that now are embracing Formula One. So long may it continue.
Well, we're a proud sponsor, and I know our customers are always clamoring over who gets to come to those Grand Prix events.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. Yourself and the Googles and the Ciscos and the Dells and the Coca-Colas. If I look just at our partners, we've got the best roster of partners in all of motorsports, maybe in all of sports. When you look at the people that we're fortunate to partner with, and you know, they help promote the sport, they help bring us new audiences, and you know, in your case and a lot of our partners' case, deploy their technology inside our race team to make our race team go faster, or to have better engagement with our racing fans, or make us work more efficiently. And so that's quite exciting for us, especially in the technology space, is how our corporate partners can help us be a better racing team.
I love that segue because, I mean, I think about the state of the world with technology in 1962 when Bruce started racing versus where we are today. And, you know, we were talking about this earlier. Everyone from the driver to the pit crews to the team, I mean, everything is precisely engineered. There's so much technology. Can you talk about, you know, how the technology has evolved, both the physical hardware as well as the data and AI, and how each of those different groups within McLaren is using technology to do better?
Yeah, it's amazing, the technology in our sport. So the size of a Formula One team is 1,000 people. We have 1,300 at McLaren, but we have the other racing series I mentioned. So you've got 1,000 people that are all working together to put two race cars on the track, which sounds quite staggering. The technology, whether it's the physical components of a race car, the safety is unbelievable in these cars. The performance is off the charts. And then from a digital and a software, we're pulling down 1.5 terabytes of data a weekend with over 300 sensors on the race car. There is absolutely nothing that we don't know about the race car in real time. That is going around the world because we're running the race in a specific country. We'll be in Holland this weekend, but our mission control, if you think of kind of NASA, our mission control sits back at our factory. We run 50 million simulations leading into and over a race weekend of the different scenarios.
So literally 50 million simulations of different conditions.
It's unbelievable. It kind of seems a bit extreme to me, but you know, our sport is so fluid. You know, we're developing a new piece for our race car every 20 minutes, 365 days a year. Obviously, they're not kind of coming out literally every 20 minutes, but if you take how many parts are on the car and you broke it down, that's the frequency. We live in a state of prototype. What's on the car this weekend will most likely change next weekend. So we're very comfortable with technology and constantly learning, because what works today we know we can improve next week. And so an interesting stat, if you took the car that qualified first at the first race of the year and it was untouched, it would be last by the end of the year. That's the pace of the development.
That is incredible, right? Yeah. It's such a metaphor for what's happening in the world, not just for race drivers, but for all types of workers, is just the amount of data, the amount of technology that we have access to. And so I want to drill down more into that. Could you give an example of a new piece, right, that is how you come up with it post-race when you do a post-mortem, and then that process of how it then gets manufactured, and just give an example, just because we're not as familiar.
Yeah, so, you know, we start in design and in CFD simulation, then it will go into a wind tunnel to confirm what we've seen in CFD. Then it'll go on to the simulator to confirm what we've seen in the wind tunnel and what we've seen in CFD. And then we actually put it on the race car. And so your correlation needs to be really strong because we have a cost cap. So we can't, which we were able to in the past, just keep developing, just spend money until you get it right. Now we need to spend money efficiently. So we need to make sure that what we see in CFD before we produce it, we've got a high degree of confidence before it goes in the wind tunnel, before it goes in the simulator, before it goes on the car. And then we're constantly trying to obviously increase performance. Weight is a big driver in performance. So we're constantly, once we've landed on something, you know, a front wing, a suspension piece, how can we improve it? How can we make it lighter? How can we make it more aerodynamic? How can we make it more compliant with the tires, depending on what the part is? So we never kind of launch a product, if you'd like, which is our race car, and go, right, that's done. We're going to market. Our going to market is for one weekend. And then we're constantly kind of taking it apart and going, now, how can we improve this? And so we live in a space of milliseconds we're looking to improve upon. About 2% covers our entire field. So if you think about all the industries in the world, the Salesforces, the Googles, the spread between the best and the worst is probably 300%, 500%, 1,000%. 2% is to separate the best from the worst. And therefore, we're playing in the smallest margins, trying to make the smallest incremental improvements every day.
It's just so fascinating. I mean, just having come off of a home renovation that went awry, right, where we had a design, we had a plan, and then we weren't able to simulate it. And so we just proceeded. And just to think about applying what you're saying to more domains and how much impact that could have in terms of helping us get things right the first time and really reducing that margin of error, as you're talking about.
That's the name of the game for us. Now, of course, you don't always get it right the first time, but you can't take 10 times, because what ends up happening is, because we have this cost cap, we're limited on how much we can spend.
Right.
You're wasting performance, chasing performance. So you need to have a high degree of confidence before you start deploying and manufacturing that it's going to work. And we've been fortunate. Our development program since the middle of last year has been spectacular. And you see other teams that have had development programs that haven't worked, and they've actually gone back to old spec because what they thought they were getting didn't translate to the racetrack. And it can happen to any of us, knock on wood. Fortunately, we're delivering at the moment, but you know, it doesn't take much to get it wrong. And so you can never be complacent in our sport. The minute you kind of think you're there, someone else is going to catch you. So we're just entering the second half of the year, 10 races to go. We're second in the championship, but you know, we know 10 races, a lot of racing, and really the top four teams have broken away from the others. And any of these top four teams can be the fastest in any given weekend. So the competition is awesome.
This is just fascinating. You're inspiring so many ideas. I mean, one of them is, I remember those Choose Your Own Adventure books that we used to read when we were growing up. And it's like you can simulate all of the possible endings and then based on that, tweak and change little pieces here and there to optimize that outcome. And just again, to think about applying that. I mean, imagine if salespeople simulated various outcomes, or CEOs simulated various outcomes beyond kind of a high-level scenario planning, but really simulated it. It's just fascinating to think about how much we can improve in so many different ways.
Yeah, we run race simulation before the race, during the race, so we know at the start of the race, if things don't change, we kind of know where we're going to finish. And obviously, we're always trying to improve where we're going to finish, so we're changing things, we're reacting, but we all have what's called a race trace, and we can monitor tire wear, anticipated pit stops, race pace, and we have this diagram that we can see the trajectory we're on or where we anticipate finishing, and then, of course, that starts driving our tire strategy, our pit stop strategy, our pace strategy to try and improve our race trace.
So I want to go to your personal story because it's really a fascinating one. You grew up in LA and you started your career as a race car driver, which I think is a dream job for so many people, my son included. Can you talk about how you became a Formula One race car driver and then how you then went on from that to becoming the CEO of the organization? Because that also is a fascinating story.
Yeah, I raced professionally for 10 years through the 90s. I started in go-karts, which is where most people start racing. I had a bit of a unique approach, not by design, but I was on Wheel of Fortune Team Week and won a bunch of his and her watches and went and sold those watches at 13 years old and bought a go-kart. And that's how I got started. And then
incredible.
I was very successful.
At 13 years old, you just...
13 years old. Yeah, I mean, Lando and Oscar started it. 6, 7, 8 years old. So that's today's age. 13 is old.
So when you sold those watches, were you had a dream of becoming a race car driver, or you were just...
Well, when I won the watches, I just kind of won the watches. But I loved the motor racing, and I went to the Long Beach Grand Prix and met Mario Andretti and got up the nerve to just ask him one question, which was, how do you get started in racing? And he said, karting. And there happened to be an ad in the race program. And I saw that. I was like, well, I want to go do that. Sold the watches, went and did that. And that kind of got it all started.
Once there's a whole go-kart racing circuit as well
Yeah, it's quite big.
And then there's... Yeah.
All over the world.
Okay. And then there's... Are there scouts who look at the best go-kart racers and then you kind of get recruited?
Correct. Correct. And in fact, we have some carters under contract that are 12, 13 years old now to McLaren that, we think are on trajectory to be a Formula One driver in the future. So yeah, very much like other sports, except probably scout a little bit younger, right? In stick and ball sports, I think the teams probably start paying attention more in high school. We're kind of watching in junior high. And so I did that for 10 years. I did all my own sponsorship. So I've always enjoyed sponsorship and networking and understanding people's businesses to help them use motorsports as a way to grow their business. So when I stopped racing, I then started a motorsports agency, which became the world's largest motorsports agency, looking after the corporate side of the sport. And we built a nice company, ultimately ended up doing a lot of business with the various Formula One teams, McLaren included. And when I sold that company, McLaren was in transition. They bought out one of their major shareholders. They were having some leadership changes. And I had the fortune and opportunity either go Formula One as the sanctioning body or McLaren and being a racer at heart. And McLaren's always been my favorite racing team. I ultimately picked that one. I was in a fortunate position to be able to choose between two dream jobs, but I like when the lights go out and we can go racing and the deal making and working with partners. And so I joined McLaren in 2017 and now in our eighth season.
It's just such a unique combination of skill sets, right? Because I think a lot of people who are the athlete or the racer, they're not necessarily thinking about the corporate side and the sponsor side. I mean, what do you think allowed you to do that? Was there a certain experience or mentors that you had?
For me, back when I was racing, I had to do it because I needed the sponsorship to go racing. So it was something I needed to advance my career, but I enjoyed it and I enjoy getting to meet people from all around the world. You're fortunate as a racing driver to meet some pretty successful people at a pretty young age. And so I always enjoyed kind of learning from them and kind of in awe of these business leaders that are running these major corporations. And then I understood motor racing and what successful sponsorship looked like and what unsuccessful sponsorship looked like. So I decided that I could use my knowledge of the sport to advise the corporate side of the sport. So I didn't represent the sport. I represented the corporate side. So I'd go to the sales forces of the world and say, tell me about your business. What are you trying to do? I'd get to understand the business. And I'd say, oh, you should be in Formula One, or you should be in NASCAR, or you should be in IndyCar, and you should do this type of arrangement with this type of team because of what you're trying to achieve in your business. So I've always come at our corporate partners from understanding their business and how can they use a partnership with McLaren to build their business. And every company has similar goals and every company has different goals. And so everything becomes very customized. I'm less technical than the other team bosses. So, you know, when I sit in aerodynamic meetings, I'm listening, but I'm not contributing too much. My job is to get the team, the right people, the right resources, the right partners, the right technology, and let them do what they do best. So it's just been something I've been passionate about ever since I raced.
I think you're being humble, though, too. I remember our conversation in Davos about AI, and you're very technical. And it's really amazing. It's about having a growth mindset.
I'm getting there.
It's about having a growth mindset and bringing an open mind, a beginner's mind, as all of us have to do right now in this completely new era of AI. And just to connect it back to that driver experience, I mean, as you were saying, we're at a point now where you have 50 million simulations, you have all of these real-time data signals coming into the driver, and yet the driver has to focus on safety. They're driving hundreds of miles per hour. How are they processing? I mean, as a driver, you can relate to this. How does one focus on the road and focus on safety and going fast, and then also process this data? Is that a certain type of person that you're looking for, or training that you provide?
Yeah, for sure. It definitely takes, and you can see this in different drivers. The capacity in which they can absorb information, almost the driving and the racing it's almost the easy part for these drivers at this level. The real challenge is how much information can they take in and not get distracted from driving. So you see some drivers that can put down an unbelievable lap time, but that's all they've got. And if you put anything in their brain, they just can't consume it. You see other drivers that can put down the same lap time, but it's almost like they're at 70, 80% of the effort, and they can just take in all this knowledge. And those are the ones that tend to have the better racecraft. So it's one thing to put down a fast lap time, but where the racecraft comes in is understanding tire management, understanding strategy, when to push, how to get the most out of your racing car. So these drivers are highly intelligent, very high IQs, and you can take the same race car and not have it in its sweet spot if you'd like, by not understanding the technology. So I think the drivers and the younger ones, now that they're growing up around things like esports and simulation, technology is easy for them because they've grown up with it. If I get in a current race car, which I do from time to time for fun, I can't take it all in. It's just mind-blowing what's on the steering wheel. We speak in code. We listen to each other, so sometimes we speak in code to get real questions answered. Sometimes we're asking questions that are bogus questions, and we want a bogus answer because we know the competition's listening to our radio.
We're kidding,
which is all legal.
So fascinating.
Bait them into a wrong strategy. So it's kind of like in baseball, the third base coach, you know, he's got all these signs going on, but, you know, until he touches his cap, the next sign is real. We're doing the same thing, but through a voice. That's something that AI is starting to work with us on.
Because I love that.
That's where we then use things like AI, and we can look at tires, and we upload them to cloud, and AI can help us go through and look at anomalies, and we can hear another driver if he's complaining about his tires. We can then quickly look at their tires and see if what they're saying is what we're seeing.
That is fascinating. So not only are they driving at super high speeds and trying to listen and look at visual signals, but then sometimes what you're talking to them about isn't even, it's a fake out.
It's a verbal poker we're playing over the radio. So it's amazing. They've got to be driving. They're trying to pass someone in front. They've got pressure from behind. They're trying to feel. They're trying to set up the car corner by corner. There's over 300 different adjustments they can make on the steering wheel. We're feeding in information to them. And then we're asking them questions that we want them to answer accurately or not accurately. Then you can maybe have some weather that comes into play. So now it's raining, your visibility is not very good. So the amount of information the driver needs to process is staggering.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, it's like high IQ in addition to everything else. At what point did the sports start to get so much data? Do you remember, was it a certain year or a set of years?
Probably the 90s, you know, we've been, you know, people are doing connected cars now. We had connected cars in the 90s. So we've always been on the cutting edge of technology.
Yeah.
But I would say the 90s is when it really started to ramp up and was kind of ahead of everyone else. And the sport has remained there as technology comes online, materials that we use, the data, the predictive analytics. It's amazing. We have the most thermal efficient engines in the world, the amount of power we're producing. We're sustainable fuels. We're going to 50% battery technology. So a lot of what happens in Formula One, you'll see on road cars, but not for 10 years because we're that far ahead on the technology curve.
That's super cool. So do you remember that moment in the 90s when this started to happen? And at what point did you realize, oh my gosh, we have to completely change how we train drivers? Maybe you had to start recruiting a different profile of driver. Tell me about that shift. Because I ask because, again, I think a lot of other industries that are behind and only now injecting more real-time data, more real-time AI, they're going to have to go through the same thing.
Yeah, I think from a driver standpoint, it was more about getting younger drivers that the technology was something that they kind of have grown up on. So, obviously very intelligent drivers, very physical fit drivers, because also when you physically get tired, you can't concentrate. So the fitness of drivers, it's always been a very physically demanding sport, but the fitness routine now of drivers, they're athletes unlike anything else that you've seen. A lot of people kind of think, well, they're sitting down on the job, but the G loads, the pressure, and it's constant, right? We have no TV timeouts. We have no timeouts. We're an hour and 40 minutes absolutely flat out. Our pit stops are 2 seconds long. So it's not like they get a break on a pit stop because they need to get ready for the pit stop and ready to exit the pit stop. So think about, you know, if you're spinning on a bicycle, doing that constantly at the highest level of intensity for an hour and 40 minutes, that's just the physical side of it. Then your brain's working at the same pace. And if your body gets tired, your brain gets tired and vice versa.
It's that connection between the physical and the mental acuity. Absolutely. Fascinating. And then what about for the drivers who were already in the business? How did they adapt?
I think, you know, we're used to adapting. That's something that, you know, we're used to developments on the car. We're used to developing race cars. So I think the technology's kind of crept up on us, right? It wasn't just a light switch. So I think for the drivers that were there in the 90s, it was quite natural. I think if you took a driver from the 90s and you showed them what was going on, they would be blown away. But I think everyone kind of evolved at the same pace. We do a lot of simulator training now, especially not just for the driving, but for the mental agility to be able to make sure, and we can see in simulator training when we start throwing activities at the drivers, which drivers can handle that or which ones start to make mistakes because they're now having to think, which is distracting them from driving.
That's so interesting. So it's like in parallel with creating the technology. You got to create the programs and the training to help the human adapt to the technology.
100%. 100%. Then a lot of training goes into that, a lot of debriefs, a lot of meetings, a lot of preparation. So a Grand Prix driver over the course of the weekend, when they're not driving or with sponsor commitments, they're in debriefs, they're looking at data. And again, that's where, you know, AI helps. We got so much data, 1.5 terabytes. What we need is the good data. So that's what modern day technology is helping, cipher through what is the good data, what is the data that we really need, because we collect so much data, but you can't possibly process it that quickly. So we need the help of other technologies to give us the data that we're looking for.
There's so many parallels to what I think every organization is looking to do right now in terms of reskilling and upskilling their labor force. And also what so many colleges, universities, K-12 education schools are thinking about: how do we adapt our curriculum, right? Not to fear the technology, not to ban the AI, but how do we teach people how to use it safely and to optimize their performance?
Yeah, 100%. I think it's the it's the youth who's going to teach us because they're just comfortable with it, right? Our kids have just grown up on devices and technology, so. Everyone inside McLaren, we embrace the unknown. We want to know what's the art of the possible. We want to do stuff that's never been done before. And it takes a certain mindset to get a group of people that kind of embrace this constant change and not have a fear of the unknown.
Well, I could see how that'd be very valuable, but that also if you're a 16-year-old driver, it might be a little intimidating to meet with the CEO or to share their thoughts. How do you encourage that type of, reverse mentoring or ideas coming from the people who are the newest to the business?
Yeah, it's we've got great managers all throughout the business. And I think, I have 10 direct reports, and those 10 direct reports probably have 80 or 100. And I think to reach the largest footprint in McLaren Racing, we need to have great kind of middle managers. And the one thing that's interesting about technology and something that we're constantly working on to improve with our people is I think sometimes in the technology business, people get promoted based on their technical know-how. Doesn't necessarily make them great managers and people skills and coaches and mentors. So that's something that we've done a lot with our team, and we've got a great culture inside our racing team, is making sure that people aren't just great knowledge of technology, but how can they help mentor, coach, guide people that work for them. And we're very open and transparent. Mistakes are okay. You learn from mistakes. I always say don't make the same mistake twice, because then you didn't learn the first time around. But yeah. The great Niki Lauda, 3-time world champion, said he always learned more from losing than he did winning.
What a great, it's like very profound.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So when we make mistakes, obviously it can be frustrating, but as long as we understand how it happened, why it happened, and how to, not do it again, then we're only stronger for it next time around.
I think that's such a great point. I mean, this happens in the software industry too, where often the best engineer becomes the engineering manager, or the best salesperson becomes the sales manager, and it's really a different skill set that needs to be invested in and cultivated and honed over time.
Yeah, managing is not easy. Comes naturally to some people more than others. But being a good manager, I mean, you could almost be a great manager and not have the technical skill set and still be a great manager and rely on your people. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not technical, so I'm certainly not guiding people on specifically how to do their job technically. I'd like to think I'm giving them the motivation, the resources, the people around them, the guidance, but I rely on them to be the technology experts. I can't really help them in that manner. I can help them in other areas so they can be the best they can be at their job.
I love that. I actually think that sometimes knowing too much about what your people do, it can be a liability, right? Because you end up wanting to jump in versus empower, let people make mistakes in a safe space so that they can grow. I love that.
Totally agree.
So we focused a lot on the driver. Now, I want to look at the other aspects of the organization and really appreciate the partnership and what a great customer you've been of our Einstein AI platform. And just to talk about, you know, how are you seeing AI change how you do marketing and how you engage with fans? How is it changing customer service? So just talking about some of those other areas.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. I mean, it's early days and that's exciting. You know, we have hundreds of millions of fans and people like different things about the sport. They like the technology, like the drivers, they like the glamour, they like that it's global, they like the race cars. And so, you know, in the good old days, we would broadcast out our message. And eventually through data and research, months later, you'd kind of find out how you're doing. Now, in today's day and age, you find out instantly. Most of the time, that's a good thing. Sometimes less a good thing on the social media these days. But AI enables us to understand what our fans want. And so we can then serve up McLaren back to them in the way they want to consume their relationship with McLaren. So it's enabled us to have kind of a customized one-on-one relationship with hundreds of millions of people because they all like different things about their relationship. They like one driver more than another. They like certain type of racing more than another. And so it just really enabled us to customize our relationships with our fans.
Yeah, and I could see how that'd be so much even more important now, as you're saying, the demographics of the audience has really expanded, more women, younger people, and just it's really exciting to see the personalization work we've been doing together.
It's awesome. I mean, at the end of the day, our fans are our lifeblood. So they're the most important part of our ecosystem. If we don't have fans, we don't have broadcasters who want to televise races. If we don't have fans, we don't have countries that want to host races. If we don't have races, we don't have TV, we don't have fans, we don't have Salesforce. So we're very focused on our fans because that's the start of our ecosystem. And the more we can be engaged with them, the more we can understand them, the more we can reply to them in a timely fashion with a content that is most exciting to them is going to just strengthen our relationships. And we have fans all over the world, all genders, all age groups, et cetera. And so, you know, how I want to consume the sport is going to be different maybe than how you want to consume the sport. And AI allows us to customize that experience.
And that's such a great mindset, right? Is that it's constantly changing. And even the example you were sharing earlier, what was state of the art at the beginning of the year is going to be last place by the end of the year. And AI,
100%.
That's where the world is going. And I know that's a reality you've been living for decades, but I think the rest of the world, the other industries that we deal with, that's what's happening now. And it's amazing.
It's going to help us drive engagement and massive productivity. I know, and I can only speak for McLaren, I know around AI, people are worried about job loss and things of that. And for us, all it just allows us to do is deploy our human capital in other areas where I don't want to reduce anything. I want more horsepower. So for me, AI is giving me more horsepower, more performance. So it's additive to what we're doing. It's making us smarter. It's making us faster. It's making us more productive. It's making us more efficient. So for us, we're very excited by AI and we're learning every day.
I love that perspective because it reminds me of, you know, some people are scared that AI will take their jobs, but it's really human using AI and data that is really going to win.
100%. It can't kind of work on its own. Then, you know, it's what, even with data, we have what's called kind of racer instinct, business instinct, which is, you know, you get all this data, but you still need to use your people power, your experience. And there's some things that data can't tell you. So, you know, how certain drivers drive, who are harder to pass than others, which ones get flustered in a certain environment. So I think we're always going to have human capital, if you'd like, running the technology. It's not as easy as the computer gives us all the decisions. What the computer does is gives us better information quicker so we can make better decisions.
I agree. I think we're going to, just like you pioneered in the 90s, I think we're going to enter a golden age of human capital that's empowered by AI, data, and technology. And so as other companies across industries embark on this journey, what advice would you have for them? And just to think back to the 90s and how you helped evolve the organization and the industry, what advice would you have for these leaders on how they can really embrace that growth mindset and adapt everyone in their organizations to this new pace of reality?
Yeah, I think it's just about incremental gains every day. And again, we live in milliseconds. So at least in our world, there's no kind of silver bullet, you know, game-changing moment. It's about all these really incremental gains, waking up every day. And we're in a sport where if you're standing still, you're going backwards because everyone else is going forward. So it's just about how do you move forward every day? And technology is such a great tool to accelerate growth and efficiency and productivity. So it's about leaning in to technology every day.
I love that. And what about for people who, you know, they're raising kids right now, or they're working with young people like the 12 and 13 year old recruits you work with? What advice would you have for how we should educate and guide the next generation to succeed?
I think it's more like the 12 and 13 year olds are going to educate us. I think it's amazing what the youth know and how they, you know, I mean, just technology doesn't intimidate them at all. I mean, they've just kind of born and raised with technology. So I find myself going to my kids who are a little bit older than that, but to help guide me. But, you know, I think there's, of course, bad actors around the world. That's something that has always existed. That's not necessarily a technology thing, but the technology's made that trickier. So I think using technology for good is obviously very, very important. But being open-minded and learning, right? I think that's the great thing about technology is it's kind of constantly training the brain, and not to be intimidated by it, and to take your time with it. You know, I'm an impatient individual, and I've had to, you know, if I download an app, I just want it to be easy. And sometimes you got to be a little bit patient and walk through it and try it and give it a little bit of a chance, because some technologies you can kind of turn on and it's instantly easy. And other technologies, you kind of changing something that's maybe been a habit that you've done for 10 years, and it's going to take a little bit of time to unwind that. So I think embracing technology and being patient with it.
Well, what great advice to end on. Thank you so much, Zach, for your time, for your partnership, for your incredible leadership and role modeling what an extreme growth mindset looks like.
Thank you very much. It's great to join you.
What an amazing conversation. Three takeaways from me. Number one is this is a sport that pioneered technology-enabled humans starting in the 90s. You have drivers receiving thousands of real-time data signals, AI-powered insights, while at the same time having to drive and navigate a car at over 230 miles per hour. Just incredible. Number two is just the importance of data and AI using Einstein and how they've been able to personalize their fan experience for hundreds of millions of fans around the world. This has been especially important as they've broadened their audience to people from all different cultures, to having more women, people from different age groups, younger people, everyone feeling like they have a unique experience tailored to their interests. And then third, last but not least, is how Zach embodies an incredible growth mindset and how necessary that will be for leaders going forward as everyone has to evolve their organizations to continuously adapt and change. That's all for this week's episode of the Ask More of AI podcast. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and follow me on LinkedIn and X. To learn more about Salesforce and AI, check out our Ask More of AI newsletter on LinkedIn. Thank you so much and see you next time.